Finn. Finn is walking back to his car from the bakery, trying to remember if there are flowers at home, or if he needs to buy some, and if the florist will even be open by the time he gets there. It's almost 6 o'clock. The Sedona sun is already withdrawing from the windows of the shops. Once it's taken itself away from the street, it will begin the process of unfastening itself from the landscape. The trees, the desert, the unearthly red rock buttes last of all. For now, though, the sky is preposterously blue and the sun is in it. Finn should really try to notice things like this more, not think about twilight or parking tickets or grey hair or the stealthy descent of his own balls towards his knees. The way they never seem to do it when he's watching, like a game of What's the Time, Mr. Wolf? Or whether the bread he has just bought will still be springy tomorrow morning. He tries to focus on the street. Sun, cars, cafe tables, a waft of smoke, of coffee. Coffee. Ree, his daughter, aged 14, has left the family home to go on a 4-week tour of Europe. She goes to a progressive private school that values experiential and intuitive learning, which apparently makes it okay to miss almost a month of actual syllabus. They do extra work at other times, Miranda said. Yes, but what's the work? Said Finn. Contemplating sunsets? Wasn't that one assignment? Going to the cinema? Taking ayahuasca? You liked that school up until now. You just don't want her to go away. Admit it. I admit nothing. All I'll say is she still drinks chocolate milk. What? She says coffee tastes like poison, said Finn. It is poison, said Miranda, sipping her espresso. The point is, her taste buds are childlike, said Finn. Too young for olives, dry wine, coffee. How can she cross an ocean and leave us with a tongue as young as that? He gets into his hot car and turns on the aircon. The harsh cold, scything his face, is as close as he'll get to an Irish climate. He feels envious of Ree, who will probably get rained on in Europe, hailed on if she's lucky. Envious and something beyond that. Some premonition of melancholy. Then he realizes he's done it again. He's meant to be trying to live in the moment. Or at least that was the idea a moment ago, before he forgot. Note to self, remember to live in the moment. Finn, Miranda and Ree live on the outskirts of town in Oak Creek Canyon. Their house is a long sub-Mies van der Rohe box, stark white, floor-to-ceiling glass windows on most sides. Apparently, it had replaced a historic, for Arizona, Finn feels compelled to add, house that had been owned by one family for over 100 years until it burned down. All that was left was the garden and an adobe wall with wonky gateposts and a noisy wrought iron gate. When the landscaper they hired to sort the garden out arrived, he said, "So you're replacing all this?" It wasn't a question. "Actually, no," said Finn. "It makes me smile, the old meeting the new." "I see," said the landscaper. "It's clever. The gate is your joke." "Sort of. But not a very good joke." "Maybe not. Not a funny joke." "Right. That's how you know it's clever." Finn didn't try to explain that the gateposts were part of the reason they'd bought the house. They'd been living in California at the time. Miranda had seen it online, sent a picture to Finn. No subject line, just an exclamation mark. It was their thing. That's what it was. Finn and Miranda's thing, born on a spring afternoon in Southwark. This is one of Finn's favourite stories, albeit one he doesn't tell at parties, because that day Finn and Miranda, the main characters, were actually accompanied by Finn's girlfriend Diana and Miranda's boyfriend Max, the supporting cast. Plus David, who knew Miranda from medical school, and David's girlfriend, what's-her-name, extras. Anyway, it was the mid-90s and they'd all had lunch at some restaurant that didn't exist anymore. Afterwards, they wandered around the South Bank and everyone else walked, talking, past the two remaining walls of the old Winchester Palace. Everyone except for Miranda, who'd stopped and was looking up at them. Finn stopped too. Diana, who'd been holding his hand, rolled her eyes and went on ahead. "I didn't know this was here," Miranda said. "City ruins," Finn said. "What I like about this particular ruin is that it's half built into that building. I don't know why, but I prefer it to something old that's been left on its own, and I definitely prefer it to something new that's totally new." "I understand that," Miranda said. She didn't seem inclined to move on. She looked up at the fractured rose window thoughtfully, as if she had a question for it. The others were almost out of sight. They'd been wandering too long, and the general consensus was that it was time to find somewhere to sit down and get pissed. "One of the best ruins I ever saw," said Finn, "was in Wales. It had the same quality to it. It was an ancient dolmen. The big rocks balanced on top of each other. The old tombs. That's it. Thousands of years old. Anyway, this one was right in the middle of a suburb. There was this empty space, interrupting a row of new houses, with a dolmen in it. You walked into this cul-de-sac, and in a square of grass, there it was, a Neolithic tomb. I can't explain why I like that so much." "It's an absurd juxtaposition," Miranda said. "Unexpected dissonance. Didn't someone once say that all jokes were the result of that?" "Those are exactly the right words," said Finn, enjoying them. "Absurd juxtaposition." Behind them, David came round the corner. He looked pleased to see them. "How did you do that?" Finn said to David. "I thought you were ahead of us."
"Had to go to the cash point," David said.
"You two look like you're scheming."
"Scheming about ancient bits of masonry," said Miranda. David said, "I love ancient masonry."
"Oh, do you?" thought Finn, as David went on enthusing about a particular stone circle in the Scottish Highlands which wasn't crowded by modern buildings like this poor palace, but was instead in the middle of absolutely nowhere. Absolutely nothing there, really, but you and the circle and the rain and the far-off sheep and this feeling of almost portentousness. Anyway, it was a pretty powerful experience. David smiled. Miranda nodded and smiled. Finn nodded and smiled, thinking, "Ha, you fool, you clot, you blew it." Finn isn't expecting to see Ree when he gets into the house, and of course she isn't there, but something about her not being there still surprises him. He walks from reeless room to reeless room, feeling quietness and tidiness for the first time, as absence. The absence is loudest in the kitchen, which is pristine. If Finn squints, he can almost see the ghost of his daughter, upper body sprawled across the kitchen island, school bag collapsed on the floor beside her, stealing the canapes Finn left out to cool. Miranda comes in, looks startled at the sight of him, then smiles.
"I didn't hear you get back."
"Oh, you brought peonies," she says.
"They're beautiful."
Finn springs over to Miranda and catches her in his arms. She puts her head on his shoulder. He feels the bones of her back, the layer of yoga muscle, the soft skin,
the silk jersey. She looks almost the same as she did when they met. More care goes into it these days, over 20 years on. She's elegant where she used to be hippie-ish, though she still has something hippie-ish about her. Her hair not quite as long as it used to be, blonde, in a carefully half-assed chignon. A tall woman, a long-footed woman, slender fingers, queenly nose. "Remember Winchester Palace," he says to her. "Of course I do," she says. "Miranda and Finn," thinks Finn into her hair. Scrappy Finn from the poorest of Irish council estates. Beautiful Miranda, descendant of rich Dutch merchants. An absurd juxtaposition. Perfect. In the half hour before the party, Finn is restless, pacing the house, rearranging things, putting them back. Miranda comes in, smelling of tuberose and orange blossom. "Mbali is coming," she says. "Oh, and Natalie and Viv DeWitt. They're new here, and I want them to be our friends, so make sure you charm them. Though I suppose I don't need to tell you that." Finn acknowledges it. His ability to charm, to put on the Finn show. A generous host, a compliment for everyone, a joke for every awkward moment, a whole repair kit of jokes. "An empty glass," says Finn. "Let me fix that for you." "It is a Kofodlarsen," says Finn. "I'm impressed you noticed. It isn't often one gets to meet another true sideboard enthusiast." "Your wine, on the rug," says Finn. "Don't apologize, blame the dog." "There is no dog? Then that's your first mistake. Always bring a dog." Miranda is the quieter one of the two of them. Not because she's shy. She's never anything other than perfectly at ease with herself. Unlike Finn, she just doesn't feel the need to make quite so much noise. She doesn't feel so much need, full stop. Of course it helps to be beautiful. The doorbell rings. "I'll get it," Finn says, leaping. "The Finn show begins," across the room. "And the project," says Mbali to Finn. "How's that going?" Finn's the architect in residence on a social housing and neighbourhood regeneration project in South Phoenix. People tend to get very solemn and admiring when they find out. To keep his ego in check, Finn's developed a little spiel in which he gives all the credit to his hero, Samuel Mockbee. "Mockbee wanted to make buildings not an egoistic thing, but something collaborative, socially responsible," Finn tells Mbali now. "I tried to think what he would have done here. Talking to the community, for example."
"Working without ego is quite an achievement," says Mbali, gazing at him approvingly.
Finn, flattered, says, "Oh no, I haven't transcended ego. With something like this, I can't impose my own identity. What I mean is, when you disregard the community, you get the spaces wrong. You have to think about how people move around, where they have to squeeze past each other, where they feel cornered, where they feel safe. So really, I have to be collaborative, but I act humble about it. And then people praise me for being humble. So maybe my ego has just found another way to feel superior."
"Now I don't know whether to praise you for being honest or whether this is another act to get more praise," says Mbali. "Oh, we're only about halfway through my ego layers," Finn says.
Miranda has appeared next to him, topping up his and Mbali's drinks.
"Your what?" says Miranda.
"Layers of self," Finn says. "And the question of whether if you peel them away one by one, you're left with anything at all." Reaching back, blind, He finds the base of Miranda's back, slides his thumb along the channel of her spine.
That's horrible, says Mbali, with a delighted laugh. Surely you're left with whatever you really are, deep down.
I'm watching a TV series right now, says Finn, and one character just told another that they don't believe in deep down. They said all you are is what you do.
I agree with that. If someone's 90% awful and 10% great, everyone says that deep down they're great. Like they're an iceberg, but all the greatness is under the water and invisible. But actually, the truth is they're just 90% awful.
Other people have joined the conversation.
That's the show with the talking horse, isn't it? Someone says.
Mr. Ed, says Miranda.
Mr. Ed said that?
Everyone laughs.
No,
says Finn. He prides himself on staying abreast of the zeitgeist.
It's a cartoon horse, a depressed one.
Miranda says, well, I'm not sure we are the things we do either. This is what I've never understood. We're told to just be ourselves, right? But we're also told we can be whatever we want. Where does that leave us? What is myself?
That doesn't make any sense, a man says.
Finn has no idea who this man is. The fat husband of Miranda's attractive book club friend is all Finn knows of him.
She would not say of anyone in the world now that they were this or were that, Finn says to the man.
Mrs. Dalloway.
Who? Says the man. She works in one of the many jewellery shops of Sedona and says really quite profound things, Finn says. You should look out for her.
I'm on the side of we can be whatever we want then, says Mbali. Because most people are terrible. At least if they can be whatever they want, there's a chance they'll improve.
Well, Miranda considers this. I think it's very rare for people to even have that level of self-awareness, let alone change their behaviour.
Okay, that's truly disturbing, Mbali says. Don't worry, says Finn. As I always say, it's not a party if you're not left questioning the nature of your own existence. More wine?
Later, after everyone has gone home, Miranda and Finn lie in bed. The house beyond the bedroom walls is very quiet. The most silent silence after the noise is gone. Sweet of you to defend my honour against Lily's husband. Miranda moves herself closer to him. Her skin is cool, even in a warm room. I love you, she says. Then she starts to laugh. I love how proud you are of knowing about a depressed cartoon horse.
Nothing gets past you, Finn says.
I'm 50. But I still want to be relevant. Is that ridiculous?
It is ridiculous.
You're relevant to me, Miranda says. She kisses him.
Oh, God, Finn says. It really is all over. We should go shopping for gravestones tomorrow.
We'll get you a really fashionable one, Miranda says, yawning.
All the kids will be taking photos of it for Facebook. It's Instagram now, Finn says, unable to help himself.
Then, I have a question.
Yes?
What you said about not having a true self, or however you put it, do you believe that?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. I like the idea of it.
Do you?
It bothers me. I mean, if you could become something different at any second, there's no guarantee you'll wake up tomorrow and still love me,
Oh, so this is about you, Miranda says.
It's about us, Finn and Miranda. They met, they fell in love, they lived happily ever after, right? Not they met, they fell in love, they lived happily for a while, they became completely different people.
I like the first one, Miranda says.
But can you guarantee it? Whatever I am guarantees it, sure.
Thanks. I feel so much better.
Finn. She puts her face close to his. He can smell the night transmuting on her skin. Wine turned to ethanol. Her perfume a vague sweetness. Didn't I say how impossible it is for anyone to change? We're stuck with the selves that love each other.
That's what I wanted to hear, he says.
She yawns again. I'm tired now, aren't you?
Definitely.
Speaking of gravestones, I'm going to design a house for Rhee next to an ancient burial mound. I could get us buried there too, in among the Beaker people,
or as near to them as we're allowed.
Ugh, I'm drunk, yes. But wouldn't it be the perfect cycle? Us ending where we began. Ruins and death and life going on.
We might need permits.
Sounds lovely, Miranda says. Let's get some sleep.
Okay, Finn says. Sleep it is.
And so they go to sleep, in each other's arms.
No, they don't.
Miranda falls asleep, and Finn, as usual, thinks on. It's the morning after the party, and Finn is lying in bed, enjoying not having a hangover. He drinks.
Of course I drink, he says. I'm Irish.
Then gets up the next morning feeling young, refreshed, and more than a little smug.
Got away with it again, Finn, you old fox.
He gets up very quietly, without waking Miranda, who has not been similarly blessed, and gets into the shower. He dresses and goes downstairs.
Rhee,
he calls, before he remembers. Silence. Broken only by the pert whistle of Miranda's phone lodged between the sofa cushions. He plucks it out. It's a message from Nepenthe, the memory removal place. Weird time for them to be sending out marketing texts, Finn thinks. Trying to attract new customers while still paying compensation to the old customers, or giving them their memories back, or whatever it is they're being forced to do. There are ads running on TV at the moment. A man in a suit asking, "Are you unhappy about your memory removal?" The man is trying to be stern and sad at the same time. Stern about the company removing memories, sad for the people who've had their memory removed. "Do you feel misled? Traumatized? You could be in line for compensation. Call our dedicated legal team now." Finn brews silver needle tea, arranges two cups and the phone on the tray, and carries it back to their bedroom. The bed is empty. Miranda is up, brushing her teeth in the bathroom.
"Good morning, Irene," she says through the froth. "Oh, I feel awful."
"There's tea here. And there are some emails and texts for you."
"From?" He unlocks the phone.
"The DeWitts, Mbali, a couple of other people."
She turns delicately away to spit out the toothpaste, then holds her hair back with one hand, puts her head under the tap and rinses.
"Would you read them to me? I haven't got my lenses in."
"Sure.
You've got something from Nepenthe. Here we go. Dear Miranda, We are writing to inform you of your full medical history in accordance with a change to our company policy. Recent developments in memory removal technology have brought about a change in the law concerning our service, and we are now required to notify all Nepenthe Memory Solutions clients of their status. What? What is this?
Miranda comes over. He holds the phone out to her. They read in silence.
As you may know, Nepenthe clients must decide whether or not to be aware that they had a memory removed. You underwent a procedure at one of our clinics to remove a short period of time, of no longer than a week, from your memory, and you opted not to know about this procedure. We are unable to give you any information about the procedure itself, including the date it was carried out.
Miranda's hand falls to her side, still holding the phone. She stares at Finn. Her mouth is very red from the pressure of flossing, the blood all risen up to the surface.
This has to be a mistake, Finn says.
They're saying you had a memory wiped. You can get it back.
Which is ridiculous. You haven't had a memory wipe.
No, she says. I can't have. They stand there for a minute, staring at each other. Then Miranda says,
but how would I know?
Okay, Finn says. You wouldn't know, but I'd know, wouldn't I? I remember when they started up. We were together. It was in the late 90s. Remember when we were house hunting and that estate agent said it would give everyone brain damage? You were explaining neurons to him. We laughed about it. Remember?
I remember, she says slowly.
She's reading the email again.
But, okay, why would you know?
Well, if the technology only came into existence while we were together, surely I'd know whatever it was that you were getting deleted.
Not if I chose not to tell you, she says. Not if something terrible happened to me and I knew immediately that I would get it erased. I wouldn't tell you because then you'd have to keep the knowledge a secret from me or get a wipe yourself.
Okay. Right. But surely there would have been some sign that something terrible had happened to you. I mean, if you came home hurt or upset, I'd know. I know you. You couldn't have hidden it from me.
I don't know, she says. I just don't know.
She frowns, evidently trying to remember. It's like watching someone reaching for a phantom limb. Miranda hates any failing of her own brain, always has, taking it badly when she can't remember a surname or calculate a sum in her head. She looks pained now. It's painful to watch.
When I was in Singapore, Finn says.
We weren't living together then.
She shrugs, shakes her head. She looks like she's about to cry. Finn takes her hands and presses them.
Listen, don't be upset. They've clearly just fucked up. Why don't you call them first thing on Monday? Find out what the situation is. In a day's time, we're going to be laughing about this.
Okay, she says.
But later, Finn thinks, that was a mistake. To say we're going to be laughing about this. To think when everything is sorted out. It was the most basic tempting of fate. schoolboy error. So it's Finn's own fault then, when a week later, over dinner, a colleague of Miranda's, named Liz, says to them,
"I hear an old friend of yours is here."
Finn has never really thought of himself as having psychic abilities. He doesn't believe in them. There's always an explanation. Still, it's strange how when Liz says, "I hear an old friend of yours is here," turning to Miranda, Finn knows who it must be. He doesn't feel it as a frequency, a vibration picked up from either of the two women. Rather, it comes from Finn himself. The knowledge rises up through him. It's simple and clear. The question is posed, and something in Finn answers. "David." Miranda blinks.
"Oh," she says.
"Who?"
"Well, it's a funny story. I was at the hospital, and there's a British surgeon here teaching some reconstructive surgery techniques. He's here for a few weeks. David Shaffa? He's very good. We're lucky to have him. Some of his grafts. Anyway, I got chatting to him, found out he was from London, studied at Cambridge, and I wondered if he knew you. He said, 'Miranda O'Connor?' 'Yeah, just a bit.'"
They all laugh.
"David," says Miranda.
"Of course."
"Wouldn't he have let you know he was coming?" Finn asks.
"Actually, he did. He emailed, but things have been slightly..."
Finn wonders how she's going to explain things to Liz. Things being that Miranda had secretly had a memory deleted, had been told later on the phone that, no, this wasn't a mistake. Nepenthe didn't make mistakes like that. And no, they couldn't tell her when it had been done, on the basis that if Miranda chose not to restore the memory, she'd retain her original right not to know anything about it. The news had upset her. It was still upsetting her. She'd been frowning into space a lot and biting her cuticles. One was bleeding. Finn himself was slightly upset. Not that he'd mention it. Things were bad enough as they were.
"Chaotic," Miranda continues. "You know how it is."
"Oh, Lord, tell me about it," says Liz.
"And I forgot to follow up."
"And now he's here," says Finn.
"What a small world it is," says Liz,
and starts talking about the really very beautiful job Dr. Shaffa did of putting someone's ears back on. Miranda's face is pointing at Liz, nodding, but Finn can see her gaze is passing straight through Liz's head and out the other side, across the garden, over the desert and forests, not stopping until it reaches the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, in which David Shaffa is probably doing something beautiful. Finn has been aware of the various Nepenthe court cases, obviously. He was interested at first, checking the news, but legal action turned out to be very, very slow. And as it had nothing to do with him, or not until a few days ago, he'd mostly tuned it out. He's known a few people who've had memories erased, like the woman at his office whose husband was shot in a robbery. She knew it had happened, but had no memory of the incident. She was doing okay, he heard. Or as okay as you can do when your husband has been murdered. Finn also knew that there was another kind of Nepenthe client, the ones who chose not to know about their procedures. The night clients. Finn never knew any of those people because they didn't know themselves. Or not until a few days ago, when it turned out Miranda was one of them. Or not until a few days ago. Finn wonders what else about his life is going to end up with this qualifier. During those last few days, Finn and Miranda have acquired an exhaustive knowledge of the subject of memory removal, via Google, obviously. "I can't believe the ruling," Miranda says. She looks tired and unhappy. "That all the night clients have to be notified. It's insane. Don't I have the right not to know? Isn't that what I paid them for?" "Apparently, that original agreement is void," says Finn, internet legal expert. Nepenthe argued that patients had signed to opt out of having the memory, but the lawyers bringing the case argued that the contracts were based on the premise that the memory was gone in perpetuity, and so it wasn't fully informed consent. Legally, there's no precedent. It's insane, says Miranda again. She takes off her reading glasses and rubs her face. "Well," says Finn, "it might help the people who were getting those traces, or memory flashbacks, or whatever they were, and didn't know if they were going mad." "A fraction of the total number of clients," Miranda protests. "Less than 1%. "Still, a lot of people. Thousands," Finn says. Wondering, what is he doing? How much does he care about these people? But on he goes. "Their quality of life. What about my quality of life?" Miranda says. She started to cry. "What about me going mad?" "I'm sorry," Finn says. "This isn't abstract. It's not a debate. I'm an idiot. I'm sorry." He hugs her. Over her shoulder, he sees himself in the glass of the window, superimposed on the red rock formations. He doesn't like his own expression. He closes his eyes. "When did you two meet?" That's what people like to ask couples who've been together for a long time. When he's asked, Finn doesn't tell the story of Winchester Palace, though privately he considers that to be their true origin story. Instead, he'll say, "There was this wedding in Cornwall, 1996, and Miranda and I danced together, and pretty much straight after that, we both broke up with the people we were with at that time, and then we got together." "It was not like that," Miranda will say. Miranda's role in the story being to deny, to roll her eyes, to laugh. "She left him for me," Finn will say. "I did not leave him for anyone," Miranda will say. "We parted on mutual and very good terms. It was actually months before Finn and I got together. She just didn't want to have chucked this guy for someone else," Finn will say. "She told me she wasn't ready to start a new relationship so quickly. She calculated that she would need 6 months exactly to think." Laughter. "Chuck is a very harsh word," Miranda will say. Then Finn will tell them how Miranda said Finn could still come over, of course, as a friend, and maybe they ended up kissing on one of Finn's friendly visits, because, obviously, she couldn't resist him. Miranda will laugh, take Finn's hand, shake her head. The joke lying in her final acknowledgement of Finn's story, that she really couldn't resist, and the thinking period was reduced to 3 months. Early release for good behaviour, as Finn says. And whoever they're telling it to will say, "Isn't that lovely?" or something along those lines. Sometimes Finn worries that the more he tells a story, the more the original events fade away. Certain elements get left out. Over time, they get forgotten entirely, or at least until something stirs them back up again. For example, David Schaffer. David and Miranda were friends for years before Finn met Miranda. They'd studied medicine at Cambridge together. Then they lost touch for a while, with Miranda living in London with her boyfriend and David in Surrey somewhere, which meant Finn spent the first months of his own friendship with Miranda not knowing that there was a David until one spring. The spring that Finn suspected that Miranda and her boyfriend were on the outs. He was told that Miranda had a close friend called David, and he'd just moved back to London. During Miranda's three-month thinking period, Finn was aware that she was also spending time with David Schaffer. They went to the cinema together, exhibitions, ate lunch. And why not? They were friends, after all. Also, Miranda had already told Finn that she wasn't asking him to wait for her. In fact, she said he should consider himself to be single. They mustn't have any expectations of each other. And so Finn couldn't have questioned her about David, even if he wanted to. He wanted to. Another of Finn's stories. A few months after Finn and Miranda's wedding, 2002, Finn was offered the opportunity to work in Singapore for 18 months. He talked it through with Miranda, and she said she understood. Miranda herself was hoping to go to Africa with Médecins Sans Frontières. She was staying on in their house in Pinner while she waited for her application to be processed. It took longer than she expected, and Finn hadn't had as much time off as he expected, and by the time 6 months had passed, their marriage mainly consisted of one visit and a lot of arguing over the phone, terse back and forths zapping over oceans and continents. Miranda explained later that it was after one of these arguments that she'd decided to surprise him. It was either that or divorce you, she said. How did you decide? Asked Finn. Flipped a coin, she said. And I'm still not sure if that was a joke, present-day Finn will say. And so Finn got back from work on a day of warm, heavy rain to find Miranda waiting for him. She was sitting under an umbrella with her suitcase on the step outside his apartment block. Even 100 feet down the street, he knew it was her, from the men passing, looking, turning their heads to carry on looking. It turned out that once the oceans and continents were cleared out of the way, there was only love left. They spent the rest of the weekend in bed. A few weeks after her surprise visit, Miranda called to tell Finn that she was pregnant and that she wanted to have the baby. Up until then, neither of them had intended to have children. Miranda had brought it up when Finn proposed. The champagne was still fizzing when she said, "I probably won't ever want children. Is that all right?" "Fine with me," said Finn. "I don't see the point of them at all." So that was that, and they could clink their glasses. "I know this isn't what we planned," she said. "I wouldn't blame you if you didn't want to do this." "It's fine with me," said Finn. And it was. So Miranda told MSF that her circumstances had changed and she wouldn't be able to join them. Not yet. Finn left Singapore and came back to London. Ree was born. It was genuinely beautiful. He found his daughter beautiful, even though she wasn't beautiful, not then, and had done unspeakable things to her mother's body. He took hold of the damp bundle, forgave her immediately, loved her immediately. And present-day Finn will often have to stop talking at this point because there's something in his eye. "Why don't you invite David over for dinner?" Finn says to Miranda, once Liz has gone. "David?" she says. "Really? I was just going to meet him for a lunch. You want to see him too?"
Why do you look so surprised? He's one of our oldest friends.
Our? I didn't think you even knew him that well, Miranda says.
It's true. Finn never did get to know David, really. There was a short period in London when they all saw a lot of each other, but then, not long after Finn and Miranda got together, David moved to Edinburgh. By the time David came back to London to work at Great Ormond Street, Finn was in Singapore. A year later, David moved to Canada. He met a woman there and got married. Finn met his wife once, apparently, but can't remember much about her, and then she and David got divorced, and David moved back to England, to Crows Hill. By then, Finn and Miranda were in America. David kept in touch with Miranda by email, and Miranda would pass on significant details, marriage, divorce, emigration, to Finn.
That's just situational, Finn says. We've just never been in the same place long enough. It's like Clark Kent and Superman.
Out of modesty, I won't say who's who. But he doesn't find his own joke very funny. He feels annoyed, even, at the thought of sharing a comic book with David. The same feeling he had when he and Miranda were looking at Winchester Palace and David turned up behind them. Miranda frowns. She's visibly choosing her words.
I suppose I thought it might not be a great time, with this Nepenthe decision hanging over me. Us.
But we're carrying on as usual, aren't we? You said you didn't want anything to change, that you needed a bit of time to absorb it, but that we'd still live our usual lives, and then...
Yes, I remember. It's just, you know, David isn't part of our usual lives. I thought maybe he'd be an additional what? An additional strain.
Silence. They look at each other. Then Miranda raises her hands helplessly.
Come on, Finn. We both know you've never liked him particularly.
What? When have I ever said that?
Years ago. You said you didn't like him. You didn't trust him.
Finn does vaguely remember something like this, now that she says it.
Years ago, he says. Before we were together.
No. It was when you were in Singapore. He was back in London. I was spending time with him, and you said he was trying to move in on me. I remember the expression because it was the first time I'd heard it.
That was it.
Well, he says now, that was a long time ago. I was away from you. I was insecure. I was being ridiculous. But the fact that I could barely remember not liking David ought to demonstrate that I like David now.
Hmm, says Miranda.
She looks like she might say something else. Then she hesitates and sighs.
I could invite him on Thursday.
Good idea, says Finn. I'll cook.